Now, here's the back to this Hawaii motif. We're talking about Hawaii, the land of rainbows. And then you end up in Hawaii in 49, and you have the experience.
48.
In 48, and you have the experience with Robert Stack and a group of people, and that's interesting. And then Doobie ends up in Hawaii, and then we end up here in Hawaii doing these interviews. 50, it's 49 years later. There's your 49.
Another 49.
Yeah, seven
times. Well, how do you know?
Yeah. Okay, and then the interesting 37-year cycle from 49 to 86 is 37, you know, Vern's birthday, you meeting, that's interesting. And then it's another 12 years from 86 to 98 when Vern dies in January 28th. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to go to back to Bob Carr's book. Here's an interesting thing, is that the Douglas Rosestone kid, here's an interesting fact that comes out later in the book. Okay, so Douglas Rosestone is an interesting...
That's his name?
Yeah, Douglas Rosestone.
Is that Rosetta Stone?
Oh, that's interesting.
Really.
Yeah. And this kid, that they get him addicted to J. Krishnamurti, and then he ends up in India with them. Well, later, he had met U.G. Krishnamurti in 66 when Bob and Ronnie did. So I'm jumping 100 pages almost. On page 191, Bob, what was that thing? You got to stop. I just want to check that. Is that? No. That whole thing where Krishnamurti told Bob Carr to stop.
Was in 66.
Yeah, 66. That happened after...
that was in the chalet.
Yeah, that was when he went and had the private meeting with a group of people. So that's after he met UG. That's after he met UG in a week or two or so later or something. Okay, so on page 191, he says, I think this is where he has a Krishnamurti talk and he has a head... while he's listening to Krishnamurti, his head starts bursting with pain. And then there's a whole pain.
Whose head?
Bob Carr's head starts bursting with pain.
And this is when?
I don't know, maybe 70. This is 79. This is 79. Before he goes and meets the changed UG Krishnamurti.
Oh, I see.
And he has this big pain, and he talks a lot about that. He talks about a strange day. The day was the strangest day. It seemed that I was coming down from some altered state, as when one comes down off a drug. Yes, he had a mystical experience, I think, earlier in the day, and then it became a headache. And, so when I got home, both Pauls were there. These are Paul Arms and another Paul. And I sat down on the sofa. I told Paul Arms about my day and how the head pain had gone away after I got to work.
What was he doing? What kind of work?
I didn't know if he was just being cool about my condition or didn't understand what was happening, but he showed no reaction to what I was saying. That would be Paul Arms. But Paul Zamarin, on the other hand, looked at me rather oddly and asked how I felt. Later, he told me I was different. He told Bob that you felt different or something, that he was emanating difference. The three of us had dinner later, and I went back into the living room after the dishes were done. We sat around and talked for a while. Then I wanted to go to my room to lie down as I felt a little disjointed. After a little while, Paul Arms came in my room, and I told him that I was cold, that my body felt like it was dead, and that at the same time there was a flow of energy coming down into my head. I told him to just stay there. Quote, Bob Carr says to Paul Arms, "You seem to have a grounding effect on me." I lay there for some time, letting the energy do what it wanted to do, moving around in my head and in my spine. Then the pain...
What date was this?
This is 79.
What date?
I'd have to look. I don't have
time. Okay, it's all right.
Yeah. Then the pain started again, and I wanted to go to sleep and try to escape it. Now, Bob Carr told me he had this pain forever. It went on until just a few years ago. There was some factor when he did something. I think it happened at night. But anyway, this pain is beginning. Does he have... Yeah, he has the mystical experience a day or so before... listening to Krishnamurti, then it turns into this pain. So we're dealing with the pain thing. I can read the mystical experience later. He says...
Well, you know, Jeddah Krishnamurti went through that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Night nightly for a very long time, maybe all his life. And what he described in one of his statements, I don't know where it is, but he said that it was that force that was too high to come in to the body completely, but it could do so when he in the middle of the night. And I think it, in his case, it caused his back to have lots of cracklings and lots of feelings.
Right.
And it was that, what was the name of the guy that was supposed to be channeling through him? Started with an M.
Through Krishnamurti, J.K.?
Yeah.
I don't know.
The Theosophy,
The Maitreya Buddha or something.
Maitreya, yeah. That was the, apparently what was affecting him. And what I say, this sort of thing may have been very well what was affecting Bob Carr.
Yeah, because Bob Carr, I think, admits in the book, he was acting out an imitation of Krishnamurti's life in some level. Because he said he quit the center like Krishnamurti. You know, he gave up the Theosophical movement. Krishnamurti did, so Bob felt that he was doing it. He even questioned, am I just repeating Krishnamurti saying it and chucking it all, right? So there is his biography is a big influence on Bob Carr. So anyway, he says, the next morning the pain was the same as the previous morning. When I entered the cafe, so yeah, he's working at some cafe. It's the cafe period. I could find the title, but anyways. When I entered the cafe, it slowly went away, but when I returned home, it started again. I think that's what he told me, that it always came back when he went home. That evening, Douglas Rosestone came over. I did not mention what was going on, but in a few minutes he began to notice that I wasn't my usual self. He said he could feel the difference and thought that some action was taking place. Some action, in quotes. When I told him what I was experiencing, Douglas suggested that I should talk to U.G. Krishnamurti.
And where was he?
He was all over the world, but, you know, different. He traveled a lot, like the Nady said he would. I didn't finish that, but it says, a great teacher puts him on the right path will help him, talking about the Nady, talking about U.G., in his 49th year, he'll be born again. That's what spun us off. We started going through this whole 49 stuff when I read that sentence.
Well, did we do a good job?
Yeah, we excellent, forever. More detail in the Akashic Records. Okay.
Don't you believe it.
Okay, it said about UG, he will always be on the move. That is true. And once he's changed, in a while, man, he never stops. Never staying in one place long, and he will live to a ripe old age. He lived to 2007, you know, like, what, 90 years, almost 90 years, I think it would be, yeah. And preaching all the richness of his personal experience, that's what he did. But back to, so here's this Douglas Rosestone. He's a key character here because when Bob's going through this pain, Douglas suggests that I should talk to U.G. Krishnamurti. Now, why would Douglas do that? He's got fascinated back in 66 in J. Krishnamurti. But Douglas Rosestone tells Bob that U.G. Krishnamurti had gone through a change during what U.G. called the calamity, which occurred in Switzerland when Douglas was visiting him in 67.
Okay.
So the Rosetta Stone guy was there and saw...
His 49th year came...
Yeah, this little kid, young kid, was witnessed that. And after that, and so Douglas is telling Bob Carr, after that process, this is almost like, this is when Bob finds out about UG, gets an update. I don't think he had thought about it for 13 years. So Douglas told him about what had happened after Bob and Connie had left Switzerland and gone to Rishi Valley in 66. Douglas seemed to be still hanging around... connected to UG and witnessed the calamity, which to me is the return of the Rai, the plane of essence, so to speak. After that process, Douglas Rosestone says, UG was a changed man, an enlightened man, although he would never say that he was enlightened. Douglas thought that if I was interested, I should write to him and tell him what I was experiencing. The following day, I wrote to UG telling him of my encounter with Krishnamurti and the kind of things that were happening to me. Less than 2 weeks had passed, and I received a letter from UG. He did remember me from 1966 and suggested that I come to India if I wanted to see him. At the time, I had no idea of leaving my job or my house, but his invitation to come to India echoed in my mind. And after a few days, I thought, why not? It was crazy. I just finished repairing the house, putting together all the things that I always wanted. I thought it would be my home for a long time to come, and I would spend many days in my Woodacre retreat. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that place. So yeah. That's when the thing happened at Woodacre, okay?
Yeah, in 79. It didn't occur to me that I should just keep the house and take off my own to India. Instead, I now thought that I should sell the house and make a clean break from my lifestyle in Marin County.
Yeah.
And he says to himself, let me put this to a test. And he called a real estate acquaintance who in the past had asked me if I wanted to sell the house, but whom I turned down at that time. When she saw the house and the work that had been done, she said that I could get a good price for the property. I signed a contract with her, and within a few days after showing the house to the agents, I received an offer. Not from a buyer, but from one of the brokers of the firm she worked for. Now I was up against the fence. Sell it or forget it. Paul thought there was some kind of change occurring in my life, and life was telling me to take a new turn. I asked Paul if he wanted to travel to India and meet UG. This would be Paul Arms, I think. He was tired of his job with Kelly, the handicapped man, and said yes, he would like to go and get out of Marin. Within a few weeks, things were moving along, and Paul's mother offered to buy him a ticket around the world. I said, quote, I need a real vacation and also try and find out if there is anything going on with me. All these experiences and pain must mean that something is happening. End of quote. I really felt that this was the right thing to do. There was a surge of new energy and a desire to leave behind old memories and the life I'd been leaving. This would be a new beginning, a fresh start, and it would open new doors and bring change. The house sold for four times the amount I had paid for it. Now I had the money in the bank, money in my pocket, and an open road ahead of me. Before the year was out, Paul and I would be halfway around the world. Within a month, we moved out of the house, stayed with Connie for a few days, and then off we were on our new adventure. UG would be in Bangalore in November. So we first traveled to Japan and Thailand, then went to the island of Bali, where we spent 2 weeks enjoying the culture and swimming in the sea. It was so great to be moving about without a care, but the headaches continued on a regular basis, and I was still having a strong sensitivity to the environment. There were certain things like food and the places I stayed in to which I would have strong reactions of like and dislike. Although I wasn't neurotic about it, but I felt uncomfortable with dirt or any kind of excess. So then they visit Singapore and go to Sri Lanka, and then we arrive in Chennai, and they end up with UG. So I want to drop that. And in the book he has pictures of them, him and Paul, with UG in Bangalore. So that is the big beginning of his life with UG. Now, I want to jump ahead, since we're coming up to the end of the three-hour section here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's...
Is that much time has passed?
Yeah, we still got about 30, 40 minutes. Okay. But... okay, just a second. I need to look at my index to...
If we're going
to
do that, I have to go to the bathroom.
Okay, let's take a break.
Okay. You think he wants to cut it off?
Yeah, he would. Scott will stop it.
All right. I'll be back in just a little bit.
Okay. Okay, now, Dave, I want to jump ahead. There's lots of details of what happens from 79 to 86... in Bob Carr and Connie and Paul's interaction with UG. It's very interesting to read. He's a very interesting wild man, a diplomatic wild man. And but in early 1980, I'm quoting from page 210 in the book, in early 1986, UG, Valentine, that's the older woman, and Kim, who is a friend of theirs, returned to Marin County, and as usual, Terry found them a house in Mill Valley. So UG was always traveling around. It's like Krishnamurti. He'd cycle through Chennai and California. He'd be moving to Switzerland. You know, he'd be dropping in throughout the year in various places. Always gathering, people would come to him and start talking to him. But they were never formal talks. So he'd just be wherever he was, and people come and visit that house, and he'd talk and all day long with people. So you're hitting the wire there, Dave. Just
yeah, I noticed.
Okay. So the interesting thing is that Bob decides that J. Krishnamurti remains in the, quote, elitist zone and giving formal talks and is not among the people wandering about like UG is. So UG is a populist version of J.K.
Yeah, but by this time, see, how much older is Jeddu? See, when did he die?
That's what we're going into. He dies in February 86, and...
Who?
J.K. J.K. Krishnamurti.
February?
Yeah.
86?
Yeah.
About the time of the shuttle.
That's right. We haven't...
Gee whiz.
Yes. And I know that that Herbert W. Armstrong dies around the time of the shuttle. L. Ron Hubbard dies in that period. The three guys die within a month of each other. I'll check the dates on Wikipedia. That's
who they are?
Yeah.
Which ones are they?
Herbert W. Armstrong, remember? The Worldwide Church of God? The most.
Oh, yes. I had a special publication of his in the apartment about the time that we made the tape.
Yeah, the Plain,
in 88.
The Plain Truth magazine.
Yeah, in 88, but it was an old one. But what I found from that was that when the Gulf War with HW, you know, the 41, happened. Now, what am I getting into here now? Just a moment. For one thing, the war was 144 nations joined together for that war.
Yeah, and in
and the Bible, Armstrong said that all these nations would meet in the desert, and it was for Armageddon.
Yeah,
and here's one of the things that, if you think of it carefully, a missile has the power of armies, right?
Yeah.
Of old, if you take the old stuff. All right. That Armageddon is actually a place that's called Megiddon.
Yep.
And west of, I think it's west, anyway, nearby, is a hill, which is called Har. So... that point is Har-Megiddon, so it's been shortened to Armageddon. And one of the missiles that Saddam Hussein sent to Israel, and I think it was the first one, hit Har-Megiddon. And so when I saw that, I knew that Armageddon had already been fulfilled. So from that time on, anybody talk about Armageddon, well, then it could be a construction, etc. But the literal interpretation of the Bible and its happening of a force of armies would meet at Har, and this enormous explosion would happen at Har-Megiddon. So I knew that Armageddon was already, it already happened. It had been fulfilled. Everything else is just juice.
Right. So you're saying since the war started in January 91 and the missile was fired maybe January 28, 91.
I wonder.
You're saying that, so you read the Plain Truth fact about that after 91, not in 88. It'd have to be after.
No, he was, I don't know that he said that. He was talking about
oh,
Megiddon and Har-Megiddon and this thing.
And that fact.
And then when I heard that it had landed there, I knew that it was fulfilled. That wasn't from his structure,
that's right.
His talk.
Yeah. You got the fact from him in 88 from a Plain Truth magazine around the time I interviewed in October 88. That fact came back when you heard on the news that the first missile hit Armageddon. That's what you're saying in 91.
Yeah, yeah. It hit the Har-Megiddon, and therefore it was fulfilled.
Very good. And
and ever since that time, that's the marker I've known. Anybody talk about it, I know that Armageddon has already been fulfilled. And all this other stuff is some other juice.
And that totally relates to the idea that the Kahuna Ring and the firing off of 64 to 69 intensified from 67 to 69, which we to the apex of polarity September 5th, 69, which we talk about in the Paranoia full interview. all that what happened in that 5-year period, 64-69, the devastation that would happen 30 years later in 94, the world would be polluted and killed and all that, was fired off faster, and
yes,
therefore any leftovers would be tinier. This is a perfect example of it. The Armageddon was so tiny, thanks to right.
And anybody trying to do heavy things would have to spend everything they've got to try to do it, and it wouldn't work.
That's right. And that's a result of Rai returning to essence. And the Kahuna Ring, okay?
And the apex of polarity, particularly.
Yes. September 5th, 69. Now, I want to give you the dates. Herbert Armstrong died on January 16th, 1986, so 12 days before the Challenger.
Okay.
Before Challenger.
Yeah.
L. Ron Hubbard died 8 days later, January 24th, 1986. So those two guys, two cults, right-wing cult Herbert Armstrong, left-wing cult L. Ron Hubbard, so to speak, you know, metaphorically,
yes,
right? And then the guy in between, Krishnamurti, dies less than a month later on February 17th, 1986.
Yeah, I see.
And you're going through that intense period in that month.
Well, that's when you put the goddamn thing on the radio.
Yeah, yeah. So that timing is pretty interesting. Okay, so now we come to the book, page 210. In early 1986, U.G., Valentine, and Kim returned to Marin County, and as usual, Terry found them a house in Mill Valley. Valentine was getting very forgetful and seemed to be losing her memory, not knowing who or where she was. The time was coming to find her a home where she could be looked after. The scene hadn't changed much, according to Bob Carr, the same people, the same. He would come to this house, and then people start coming and talking to U.G. A few new faces, but mostly the regular gang was coming to see U.G.
Now, where was this located now? It was in Mill Valley.
Yeah, Mill Valley.
Yeah.
In early 86, right when everybody's dying and when we're doing the thing on the radio. Okay?
Yeah.
Narayana Murthy came and stayed for a week, and during that time, he couldn't sleep. U.G. pounded him until something broke inside him. He means, you know, dialoguing and therapeutic stuff.
You whatever. Sure?
Yeah, good point. U.G. pounded him until something broke inside him. Yeah, he broke a leg. Yeah, Bob will laugh when he hears this. Okay. A friend of U.G.'s who lived in Ojai called U.G. in February to tell him that J. Krishnamurti, who was now 93, was dying of cancer. And, yeah, we were talking about the birthday. So Krishnamurti is 1895. So
what is his birthday?
May 12th. 1895.
He was a Taurus. Okay, May 12th, 1895.
Yeah. Right, and U.G. is born 1919, so it's like 22 years later. Let me just check that. I want to get U.G.'s birth date. Just look up in the wiki here. U.G., if he's 22 years.
24, wouldn't it be?
It's probably 24. Or
95 5 and 19 is
1918. I thought it might be 19. 1918, so 23, your number, May 23rd.
Yeah.
23 years later, U.G. is born on July 9th, so he's a Cancer.
And they're born in approximately the same area of India.
Yeah. Okay, so that means that 93, so U.G. is 70 at this point. Does that make sense? No, no. 93, and then take away 23 is...
He'd be 70.
Yeah, but lose another 20. Yeah, okay. All right. All right. Well, okay, so, well, U.G. died in 2007, so he was 90. He was 90 when he died. Almost 90. 1918 and 90 would be 2008. So he was 89 when he died. So, yeah, approximately 90... Well, no. The problem here is that Bob's got the wrong number. He's 91. Krishnamurti dies when he's 91, not 93. That's what's confusing this. So Krishnamurti, who was now 93, no, he was 91, and 23 years back takes it to 88, 89 for, he'd be 67, 68. Yeah, so U.G. is 68. Krishnamurti's 91.
In Mill Valley, as this stuff was happening. Isn't
yeah. So
our friend, for our conversation so far.
Yeah. A friend of UG's calls U.G. to tell him that Krishnamurti, who is now 91, was dying of cancer. J. J.K. was staying in the little house where he claimed to have had his mystical experiences in 1928. Mary Zimbalist had...
No, wait a minute. J.K. was staying in the little house where he claimed to have had his... Is this in Ojai?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been in it.
Yeah, did you know that Krishnamurti died in Ojai? I don't recall.
I don't know, no, but I've been in the house. I don't know where he died. I thought he died in India, but I don't know.
No, it says here in the wiki, his last public talk was in Madras, India, in January 86. And I've seen that the tape of that talk on New York TV.
I think I had it. I may have it, but of course, you know, I lost so much of my paraphernalia, I don't have any idea whether I do or not.
Okay, so a month before his death, at home in Ojai, California. So he was in the little cottage, okay? So it says Mary Zimbalist had enlarged the little house, and she was staying there with him in his last days. Of course, the news was traveling around the world. His close friends were keeping watch over him and trying to keep him as comfortable as they could. UG said very little about JK, I guess, as he was aware of this, or he didn't know until this moment when the guy called. So UG is not saying much about JK. But he had been keeping himself informed of JK's condition through his friend in Ojai. So okay, UG is tracking it for a week or two or something through his friend. But this particular night, the friend calls. The friend calls. Then, several evenings later, UG called us at home and asked if we could come over right away to see UG, where he was staying in Mill Valley. So he's asking Bob Carr to come over and see UG while Krishnamurti's dying, and UG is aware that Krishnamurti's dying and keeping up on it, being informed, right?
I see.
He said, so UG calls Bob Carr and says, come right over, right away, now. So Bob Carr says, we jumped into our car and arrived at UG's house. Kim let us in and said, quote, UG is in his bedroom, go in. So they go in, and UG was seated in the middle of his bed, cross-legged, and he was dressed in his pajamas. He looked up at us and he said, quote, I don't think I'm going to survive. The energy is so strong, the body can't take it, unquote. Then UG added, quote, all the papers are on top of the chest. Everything is in order about what to do, you know, if he dies, unquote. Then UG became silent, and as we were looking at him, we could see ripples from the top of his head moving down his face. The skin had waves or ripples moving down. That sounds like your haunted house experience. Okay, his whole body was undulating. UG again said that the energy was too strong. It was strange to be with him during this episode. See, this is remarkable that Bob Kerr witnesses this.
Yes.
Or he and Paul. Paul and I both felt that by being there, we were helping him in some way. But how, I didn't know. We told him, quote, no doubt, it's the old man. That's what their phrase was for Krishnamurti. So Bob Kerr says, no doubt what you're going through, UG. It's the old man. He's going, and the two of you are linked, whether you like it or not. UG exclaimed, oh, no! You know, that they were linked. He did not want to be linked. And then Bob Carr says, look, UG, you both are two sides of the same coin. That's what Bob Carr said. We stayed there with him, and the energy kept coming in waves as he sat still with his eyes closed in a yoga posture. What a strange scene it was, says Bob Carr. One man in Southern California was dying, and another man 400 miles away was in some way connected with his death. Here was another mystery unfolding about the two Krishnamurtis. Their lives were in some way connected. Yet even to this day, you won't get an answer from UG about it. He denies that JK played any part in what happened to him, you know, in his life or in after the calamity, I think. I'm not sure. Or any part in what was going on that night. I'm not sure. So he said, UG denies that JK played any part in what happened to him. Yet UG once told me, quote, without him, I would have never come into this state. He pushed me to stand on my own two feet, unquote.
And I can say the same thing about Bob Carr and me.
Yes, Bob Carr pushed you to stand on your own two feet.
Well, the point is that time when I had first talked to him, and then he showed me that they had an apartment in the house, and we went there, and then I stayed. And a few days later, he came to see me because he hadn't seen me come up or anything. And he said, well, just a minute, I'll be back. And he brought me these two books, by Krishnamurti and Joel Goldsmith, The First and Last Freedom and The Infinite Way. And he said to me at that time, just so you don't think you're unique.
Mm.
And that was a key to my life.
Yeah.
From that point on.
When that happened in the fall of 56, we would say.
I suppose it could have been.
Yeah, because it's a few months later you do acid, and that's in March, February, March. 57.
Yeah, because the event, September 56 is where the things happened at 518 West Roy, but I don't know how long it took me to actually get to connection with Bob Carr. It was a month or two, I think.
Right.
But it could have been longer. But at any rate, I was not very long at the center before the acid trips happened.
Okay, so you could have been this incident with Bob Carr, this important key, may have happened in January 57, so to speak, right? You know, if it...
Yes. Around the time of his birthday?
Yeah. Well, did the haunted house experience happen on September 5th, 1956?
No, about the 20th, September the 20th.
Okay. So what... He continues.
I figure is around the time of the equinox.
Okay. He says, after UG once told him, without Krishnamurti, I would have never come into this state. He pushed me to stand on my own 2 feet. So, but he other times denies that JK played any part in what happened to him. Well, he didn't, because he had to disconnect from JK to have the calamity happen, I guess. So it's sort of a paradox, but not.
Yes, but don't turn somersaults in your brain over that stuff.
Yeah, semantics. Okay. We stayed for over an hour, and finally UG told us he felt normal again and was fine. In some way, both of us seemed to help ground him, as we didn't in any way overreact to whatever was going on with him. So they grounded him by not overreacting, by watching his skin go through these undulations. He seemed okay, so we felt we should leave him so he could rest. On the way home, we talked about what we had seen and concluded that we didn't really understand just what had happened to UG. The next morning, we learned that Jay Krishnamurti had died the previous night, same time.
Uh-huh.
UG suddenly decided to give up the house once, I guess, he heard that Krishnamurti
What
died.
About Bob's headaches?
Yeah, well, they
when
come
does
and
he
go.
Say, when did they stop? Did they stop?
They only stopped a couple of years ago, he told me.
Oh,
they go on for 25 years.
What? When did it start?
79.
That he had this headache for
till about 2 or 3 years ago.
Oh my God! When I was there on the balcony with him in '86, he must have been having the headache, and I was with him for 2 hours. He couldn't escape because that's how he tried to go in, and he accidentally locked the door.
That's right. Locked you guys out.
There was something I was starting to say he didn't want to hear about it. I think I was going to be telling him something about our trip in awareness, but he didn't want to hear anything. But anyway, we wound up sitting there for 2 hours until Paul came back and let us...
Yeah, who came back?
Well, his lover.
Paul. Yeah, he was forced to be with you for 2 hours because he accidentally locked you out onto the balcony or something.
He locked himself and us out there.
Yeah, and so he's forced to stay with you, and then that's the night you then leave feeling a little uncomfortable and go to the out in the town, right?
Yeah.
We discussed that earlier. Okay, so he says, the next morning we learned that Jay Krishnamurti had died the previous night. UG suddenly decided to give up the house and take Valentine to Bangalore. He told us that this phase of his traveling with Valentine was over, that she should stay with people who could look after her, that she was too old to travel, and that her mental capacity was failing. At times, she didn't know where she was or who people were. She'd been traveling for the last year, but she never complained or made problems. We were with...
What nationality was she?
I think she's Swiss.
That's what I thought, too. Okay,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So, we were with UG the last night of his stay. The three of them would be gone the next day. UG said that things would be much different in the future. He would travel alone and visit more countries, not be taking a Valentine with him, or Valentine, or whatever. So JK's death seemed like it would trigger a change in UG's lifestyle. But what that change would be, none of us were sure. Knowing UG was like... Knowing Eugene was like being in some unusual relationship without any ties that bind. It was impossible to build up anything fixed or permanent with him. Those around Eugene are all dealing with an image that they have about him, and that image... Why do you laugh at that point?
About all those people around that have images of
yeah.
him. Yeah, I mean...
You're familiar with that. So.
Oh, yes.
So those around UG are all dealing with an image that they have about him, and that image is not what he is. What he is, I don't know. And this is after he read many pages of stories of weird things and intense things he did with people. And the main thing UG did was say, it's ridiculous to look for enlightenment or any religious thing. To me, he acted out the annihilation of Rai. He said, Rai creates this idea there's something significant going on here, and there's nothing significant going on here. That was Eugene's main message. And so he would make fun of all the gurus and everybody, and make fun of people who came in looking for
well,
gurus.
Well, Krishnamurti did too.
Right, but Eugene did it in the street, and more on a more intense, rude level, and it's like Leary said, LSD and marijuana were the drugs for the soft 60s, and then you get into the hard Republican era of the 80s, so people take cocaine and heroin, you know. So you're into the 80s and 90s, you need a harder version of Krishnamurti, and that's UG.
Not really. That, I don't get that. In the first place, I think an awful lot of people liked the LSD, but they couldn't control it. But they could control cocaine, so that was their substitute for taking LSD. And it got them into trouble because they were trying to get control. And you see, the medicine is the control that controls the control.
Right, and that's exactly what the Evergreens say about LSD and cocaine. They agree with you exactly on that point.
Well, isn't that nice?
Yeah. okay, so he says, what UG is, I don't know. And the more I try to create some thought that could capture or describe him, the further away I am from him. We learned later that UG had set up a house in Bangalore for Valentine to live in and be cared for. Chandra Skar, his wife Sugana, and their two daughters moved into the new house and would look after Valentine there. Now she would be living with a family she knew. UG arranged everything. There was enough money from Valentine's Swiss retirement funds that took care of all her expenses, including hiring ladies to take care of her and any medical needs. For a man who has no possessions or property, UG is a genius at making things work in this world. Kim stayed on for some time so that Valentine would not be perplexed by not seeing UG. She and UG have been living and traveling together around the world for a long time, I guess since the 50s. Without Valentine with him, UG began to travel from place to place more frequently and soon came back to California. This time he stayed at Terry's little apartment in Mill Valley. UG liked the apartment and stayed there for many more visits throughout the next few years.
Now, who's Terry again?
He's some friend of Bob's. I'd have to go back.
I heard you mention him before. Okay.
Yeah. Terry had the place before, the place where UG was when Krishnamurti died.
Mm-hmm.
Terry would always move out when UG came and either stay with friends or stay in another little place.
Really?
Yeah. And stay in another little place that was rent-free. All these people just loved UG. You know, they'd do anything for him. There was a hardcore group of UG's friends, and we were there with him every day. UG called Terry's place the Crow's Nest, as it was on the top floor of a house next door to a mortuary. A fitting place, I often thought. It was obvious that what UG was intent on doing was to kill us off, to undermine the belief that we have separate identities apart from life, so it's right beside the mortuary. He is a master at knowing just where to put in the needle that delivers the poison. The years during which UG stayed at Terry's was the most intense period of time for a small group of us. Paul Lynn, Douglas Rosestone, Terry, Paul Arms, Krim Netterboff, and myself were seeing UG every day and spending long hours with him. All our different problems were exposed, and we felt naked, however unpleasant it was to be so exposed. Now, Dave, you can see some of these encounters on YouTube now. Bob taped them at the time, or later ones, but you can see them. Douglas and Terry had problems with each other. The contention between them dated back many years. Douglas had been lucky in business, and now he was living like a fat cat in a big house. He was part of the Silicon Valley.
Douglas?
Yeah, Douglas got into making money in the computer business. Did well.
This is the little guy, the Rose?
Yeah, Rosetta Stone. Yeah. The guy who had seen the calamity of UG in 67. had witnessed it and had first met Bob in college.
So he was in Silicon Valley, huh?
Yeah, and he did well. And so he was living like a fat cat in a big house. Yet deep insecurities made him difficult to take at times. He often boasted about his money and how successful he was as a businessman. But UG kept hammering away at Douglas, warning him, quote, "Lady Luck smiles only once. Don't think you're going to get any more money." So Paul Lynn was between two marriages and going through a total change in his medical practice. Krim had met UG years before when he was a teenager in Switzerland. He now was living in Mill Valley with Alina, his girlfriend, who years before had emigrated from Russia, and she had some real mental problems that Krim was not addressing. How he could put up with her tantrums was inconceivable to the rest of us, who all urged him to move out, you know, Krim to leave Alina. But then she became pregnant, making the problems in the relationship more difficult to solve. See, there's the ISIS maneuver, right?
Uh-huh.
Terry had some real health problems. He was a cancer survivor. As well, he had been born into a world of ongoing problems. His parents were early communists and had been hounded by the House Committee for Un-American Activities. His life had been made difficult by his father, who brainwashed Terry to believe that there was hope that sometime in the future, mankind, through its institutions, would bring about social and economic justice for the betterment of all. UG blasted Terry endlessly for his outdated ideas about equality and justice for all. I think we would have had a great time there, Dave. We should have been there.
Well, no, I'm glad I wasn't, because I had parallel situations that I handled differently. But
right. Right.
But I understand. I could say there, but for the grace of God, go on. Or else, you know, I think I got it all at once in that haunted house thing, and it served me well.
Right, because it's funny. I've told Bob Kerr, or I'm going to tell him, that UG sounds like a combination of you and me, so it's the right time to tell you this if I haven't already said it.
That's
what?
Are you a double Gemini?
No, not double Gemini.
You're not?
No. Okay, Terry had met UG sometime back when he went to Switzerland to hear Jay Krishnamurti. You see, all these people are into Jay Krishnamurti, and then they end up in the UG circuit. Okay? So he had met UG sometime back when he went to Switzerland to hear Jay Krishnamurti, and now this strange man, UG, was uprooting his whole thinking structure. Paul and I, that'd be Paul Arms, Paul Arms and I rounded out this merry group of searchers who came to know this rather remarkable man who was tearing apart the whole fabric of human thought as a means to change the world and ourselves. UG once said about Paul Arms and myself that we knew our limitations. Often Morty, this guy, Natarayana Morty I mentioned earlier, Narayana Morty, often would come to spend some time, and later Julie Thayer became a new member of the tribe. She had no idea what she had gotten into. Her whole life was altered by this man's impact on her. There is no way she could go back to the social life, I guess high social life, she had known in New York, where she lived in Manhattan overlooking Central Park. She was freed from the false forms of self-knowledge, those being psychoanalysis and other forms of help. Now she was stuck with UG. Now, how are we doing for time here? We're going to end in a few minutes, but I'm going to just carry on here because it's the end of a chapter, and it's interesting. So he goes, "What is operating in UG is something beyond our understanding. It just was not possible to know or truly understand what was there. We can understand his words and their meaning, but that wouldn't penetrate the walls of armor we have built for the millions of years that mankind has been on the planet." See, that's a Rai action he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
"We had all gotten into the same boat, hoping that it would carry us to safety," there's the running from God, "but not knowing that there was a hole in the boat. The water was coming in, and there was no time or means to fix the leak. If there was any part of my life that was the most important time, well, this was it." And this is in shortly after Krishnamurti died. So this is 86, 87, 88. UG was on fire, and the flames were burning everything around us, and the last to go would be ourselves. For the next few years, we witnessed the effect that this man had on people, and we also watched a new development unfold, UG's use of the media. A television interview in 1988, that's when we did ours, Dave, in 1988, in the series called Thinking Aloud on the PBS network. You ever see that? Conducted by Jeffrey Mishlov. I've heard of him. He's carried on with this New Age kind of programming for decades. Quite well known in that world. in that circuit. A television interview in 1988 in the series called Thinking Aloud on the PBS network, conducted by Jeffrey Mishlove, was one of the first media interviews that UG gave. Later, he's interviewed in India, London, New York, and Holland. Terry Newland and Narayana Murthy put together a second book, The Mind is a Myth, which also came out the same year. Later, more books were published. This Narayana Murthy guy does the publishing thing. Time went by, and in 1990, Terry went to Mexico to look for a place to live. He remembered fondly how he'd been there 20 years before and thought he would like to move there. However, he returned to Mill Valley rather quickly, and he laughed, telling us of his attempt to find a place to live there now, as everything had changed so much. Since UG was staying in Terry's little abode, Terry went to house sit in Paul Lynn's house, while Paul and his wife Bonnie went on a trip to Asia. Okay, 2 days later, Julie and Leslie McKenna, who also had both left Andrew Cohen's group after meeting UG a year or so before, went to Paul Lynn's house to check on Terry at UG's request. Apparently, Terry had missed a medical appointment, and the hospital had called the Crow's Nest asking after him. They found him in the front room. The television was on, and Terry was lying face down on the floor. He was dead. Later, it was determined that he'd been dead for 2 days, killed by a massive heart attack. Julie and Leslie called the authorities and also called UG to let him know. UG came to the cafe and told us, this is when Bob had his cafe, and told us Terry is dead. Paul and I felt such a shock at our good friend being gone. It was hard to believe, but UG was not in any way distraught. He did not seem to feel any loss. That afternoon, Paul and I spent time at Terry's place with UG. We made some phone calls, including to Terry's parents. They were, of course, shattered by the news. In the next few days, UG handled every detail. He bought Terry's furniture and gave the money to Terry's parents, and then gave away the rest of Terry's belongings. He paid for the cremation and other expenses, and everything was handled with care. Then he told everyone that the Crow's Nest was finished and that life moved on. Terry was free of his burdens and was suffering no more, UG said. So in the coming months, Julie spent an increased amount of time with UG, and plans were being made for her to travel with UG on a trip that would include India, Australia, and Europe. They would spend 6 months together. It would be a real test for anyone. Most people just have to have a break from UG now and then. Julie had bought a video camera and was taping their travel and UG's encounters with people. Paul and I were stuck in Marin with our restaurant and all the problems one has when you run a business. Douglas went to live in Saipan.
Now, this is in 86, right?
No, this is 90.
Oh, this time it's 1990.
Yeah.
And so Connie's out. He doesn't
mention. Yeah, Connie's not around. We'll get into that the next taping, what happened to Connie. He's with some famous guy, the guy who created Pong or something, the first computer game in the 70s. So Connie and his girlfriend, I don't know if they married, were taking care of that rich place. So they were living well on this estate and having a good time. So Paul Arms and Bob are stuck in Marin with their restaurant and all the problems one has when you run a business. So Douglas Rosetta Stone went to live in Saipan to save on the income taxes he would have to pay on the money he received for his share of the business.
Now, who did?
Douglas Rosetta Stone, the guy with the money.
Yeah, but why did he go there?
To save on the income taxes he would have to pay on the money he received from his share of the business.
So
he was just trying to avoid taxes.
Okay.
Paul Lynn bought a health clinic that offered alternative medical services. Kim and Elena were having problems. Connie was unable to work because of his drinking. Everybody else that we knew was in deep trouble but didn't know it. So that's the end of Chapter 14 called Picking Up the Pieces, and then it goes into Chapter What Happens After Terry Died. So we're going to end there for today.
Okay.
And one little thing, if I can find it quickly, that we need the other... The other mention of... Oh, yeah, page 138. The other mention of you, which is curious, and you gave a hint of it a couple hours ago. These talks of you, you know, talking to Lewis and Clark and doing that in 67, well, somewhere... And I saw Bob Carr speak in 69-70, but here is the other mention of you. And this has to be 66-67. Because they haven't, this is after they've come back.
Yeah?
Yeah, they've come back from their trip and seeing UG in 66 and being with Christian Murray and Rishi Valley. He says he was asked by a University of Washington student body president, Tom Gunn, to give some talks to students up there. And then he says, he gives some talks. This is after he's come back from India. And he says, later on I was invited to give some talks at a conference on the new awareness, capital N, capital A, on the new awareness at a student project at Stanford University that summer.
Right.
That would have to be the summer of 67.
That was when we were having the series of seminars, and he was brought in. I even saw a brochure or a sheet about that, where he talked in the...
Well, let me read what he says here. He says, see, so you're clarifying something that I wasn't sure if it was accurate or not on his case. But he's saying, one of my former friends, David Wooster...
And how does he spell it?
W-O-O-S-T-E-R.
Okay.
Not Wooster, W-H-O, is the previous...
And not the proper spelling,
right,
but the sound spelling. Okay.
Yeah. So he's invited to give talks at Stanford. One of my former friends, David Wooster, who used to attend the center... Used to attend the center, Dave. No, he didn't live there. He attended it. David Wooster got in touch with me. He was involved with a student on-campus program. It had been some time since Dave and I had seen each other. David had heard about the talks that I'd given at the University of Washington. Connie wanted to visit the Bay Area, so he and another friend from Mexico, Gonzalo, and I drove to California. I stayed with David at the house of one of his friends. I gave three talks that were open to the public, and the lecture room was full each night. After the last talk, there were questions. I saw Alan Naude, who was also invited to the conference. Okay, so I don't want to go into this too much, but...
the interesting thing is, I wasn't there.
Yes, that... And we're
Paul Seibel did the arrangements pretty much with the...
Couldn't have been Paul Seibel. Paul Seibel didn't connect with you until 69. So let's leave that confused.
Now, wait a minute. This thing of Paul Seibel was the...
No, Paul Seibel's in Vietnam. Now here.
No. Wait a minute.
This Stanford trip
was in about 70 or...
In 71. Yes, that's confused. Now we're talking this summer of 67.
Now, where did you get the summer of 67?
According to his chronology, right here. He's just come back from India.
No, but I do remember something where we were riding in the car after they came back from India, and this sports car, we were driving down the highway, and I made a comment. I said, do you remember the first acid session? And they both roared with laughter, and they said, David, don't you realize this is still the same one?
Okay.
Now, that was in about 66, 67, after they came back.
They come back in April 67, March, April 67. They get into the light shows. By the fall of 67...
And we're the ones who brought them up.
Right. By the fall of 67, he goes up and starts doing light shows.
But he doesn't mention us being involved in that either, does he?
No.
and they wouldn't have never gotten up there and done it if we hadn't paid the way.
Yeah, he emphasized the Boyd guy. Remember Boyd?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
I know.
You knew Boyd, right?
Yeah, the point is, Boyd, we set the thing up at the Norway Center. They came up and did it, and Boyd came to the Norway Center and hired them on the spot for the light show at the Eagles Auditorium after that, and they stayed for all that time. Well, anyway, go ahead. It's happened over and over again where I've put people together and they forget how they met.
Right. You're saying Norway? The
Norway Center was an auditorium, a center that had kind of...
Not where you anyway. Not where you live. But anyways, you're beginning to channel.
That was down on Elliott Way in Seattle by the Sound.
Okay. The point is, this is summer 67. You're beginning to channel awareness. You also interact with the Evergreen people and the Lewis and Clark. And at the same time, Bob, you're taking Bob up to Seattle. He gets up there in the fall of 67. And Bob is thinking this is when he gave the talk at Stanford University. You and I think of this as 71. I don't.
Well, he may have done something at UW, and he may. But anyway, it was.
No, at Stanford. We're
going at Stanford, and I thought he was back in San Francisco at that time.
That's right. He had gone. He's 71. He's leaving. He leaves Seattle. Yeah, maybe 71. He's down in San Francisco. He left Seattle.
Yeah, we got Alan Watts to come too.
Okay, I think we actually got to this point about Boyd and the retina circus at the end of our previous three-hour session, and now we're back again. We got to end here, Dave. We're going to pick up at this point and work this out, whether he's talking about being brought down by Paul Seibel in 71, but I don't see him. He'd be down in San Francisco, so...
I think they're already in... See, he's left out a whole couple of years there.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's... Maybe there's other things in there, but he, I think, is in San Francisco when he gets invited to
Stanford in the summer of 71.
And I think Paul Seibel arranged it, but I'm not positive. But I know that I wasn't there because I would have been thrilled. And what?
You weren't where? You were at Stanford.
I was not in Stanford at that time.
What time?
When Bob Carr was there, I was not there.
Okay.
I was very happy that he came. And all the rest of it, the same. But I was there when Alan Watts came. But I was not there when Bob Carr came. But I saw the brochures.
Yeah,
and,
you
and I even read the transcript that was lost later. But I read the transcript of what he did there. And
yeah, you were.
And there was a house that he went and stayed, but. I wasn't there.
Dave, you were there other nights giving your own series.
Well, look, there was the seminars were went over 18 months.
Oh, okay, all right. I don't want to go into the details. That's
there's
it.
A whole series, and so this, he was about, I think Bob Carr was about the fourth person to speak.
Gotcha, I got it.
And I think Alan Nade was either just before or after. So
right.
They were...
And he's placing all this in 67.
No,
Okay, so we're going to begin with that confusion and that thing, and he thinks you're bringing him down there in 67.
No, it's like he doesn't say it was in 67. He just shows a series of events, and we have, I mean, you have put together some timing that he didn't state.
No, it's right here. Right here he says that same year, J.K. restructured his centers in India, England, and America. The new organization's name was the Krishnamurti Foundation, with new people in place to run it. J.K. made every effort to clarify that the foundation was only in office to take care of material things.
The one thing I do know is that August the 8th was when Servants of Awareness was incorporated, and I believe August the 8th was when Krishnamurti's foundation in Europe was founded. We found out it was the same week. We didn't know about it. We did this, and when we found out about it, says, "Well, we're on the same wavelength."
Right, and that's 1968.
That's in 1968.
Yeah, so that's what Bob thinks. This is going on in 67, 68. He thinks that's when this is happening.
All right, except after 68, there were a year or two before the things happened at Stanford.
Yeah, they happened in 71.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to leave that there, and I'm glad you mentioned that August 8th. That's an incredible date. August 8th, 08, 888 was the amazing Beijing opening ceremonies last month.
And yeah, and this would have been 1968.
Yeah, it's 40 years. 40 years exactly.
Really?
Yeah, think of that. And August 8th, 08 was incredible in the stuff that I can't.
But as far as that date with the actual date, I'd have to have that if you checked, but I'm pretty sure of it. Anyway, isn't this interesting?
Yeah, it is. And we haven't got much time, but we were going to say something about today.
Oh, I received a letter from the auditor of the county that my ballot went in and it was not postmarked in time for it to count.
Yeah.
I mailed it early. So I feel that something is wrong, and since I've heard so many stories about the way in which they're fooling with voters in this country, I've decided that since they tried to take my vote away, that I'm going to make my vote count. And the way I'm going to do it is to send the energy along the line that everybody, if it was me, all right, I'll take the problem. But if it was not me, which I'm sure it isn't, every person in the post office that mishandled it or anywhere up the line that mishandled it so that my vote didn't count, that kind of thing, if it ever happens in the United States of America between now and the first of the year, that I'm sending a jolt of energy out, and it's going to go out every 37 hours for 21 days, and then it's going to repeat and every 37 hours for 21 days and so on until after the inauguration of our next president, so that everybody's vote, everybody across the country who is going to try to interfere with any vote is going to be confronted with that energy. You see what I mean?
Yeah, that's important, and you said it.
Yeah, here. Well, I think what it'll do is anybody who's doing something wrong, it's going to be beyond their control. It's going to blow up in their faces, and if it happens all across the country, I'll be celebrating that my vote counts.
And this is a perfect way to end a session that concentrated on the synchronicity around January 28, 1986.
Yeah, but this thing, the synchronicity starting on this, started on Saturday.
Which
Saturday evening? Saturday about 5 o'clock.
September 12th.
September the 12th at 5 o'clock. And you figure 37 hours after that, from here, every 37 hours from here on out. Now, see, the idea
guess
is...
Guess what happened 37 hours later? Lehman Brothers went down. Merrill Lynch went
down.
You see? Yeah. What did you say? You said you'd
you
see?
See?
You see? I see. Okay, man. Look, we got to end. There's a lineup here. Other people want to get in there and tell their story. So.
All right.
So thank you very much, Dave. Fantastic. Yeah. And we will continue soon. And
all right. Lots of light around you. And pass it on. And what was that other phrase?
Hack it on. Hack it back.
Hack it back. That
and then
it.
The fourth one is when the way is made clear.
Oh, yes, when the way is made clear.
And you just did that by the historical replay and clearing up the next 2 months, 3 months.
Yes.
Okay, great.
All right, lots of light around you.
Thank you.
Au revoir.
Bye.